Which I understand. What I don't get is why they would build one.
They didn't. We did. We built it.
And I'm not an idiot. I know that. But why did they build one too?
They didn't. It's ours. The one we built. Or, you know, I guess technically the French. But us. We did that.
I still don't understand how it got there.
It's exactly where it's always been. That's the whole point. It's the whole point.
I get that space travel is wonky in sci-fi, but this just... it feels like a massive plot hole.
It's not. You just don't understand it.
Okay, let me try this one more time. They're riding on the beach. Then Charlton Heston sees the replica Statue of Liberty submerged in the sand. Then he goes crazy. And then sort of a... I don't know.
Okay, take the word replica away from that sentence.
Why would the French build the apes another Statue of Liberty?
From the Alan Smithy Memorial Studio, this is the Broken Projector Podcast with Scott Beggs and Jeff Latula.
Welcome, everyone, to another parsimonious episode of the Broken Projector Movie Podcast. I am your host, Scott Beggs.
And I am your truculent co-host, Jeff LaTulip.
You just picked a couple of vocabulary words for the opening there, didn't you? They don't really mean anything, like, for this episode, do they?
Ecclesiastical as always, my friend.
This week on the show, we'll be talking with independent filmmaker Joshua Caldwell and producer Travis Oberlander, who will explain to us how to shoot a professional-grade feature-length film for $6,000. You heard that right.
$6,000. Also, to celebrate America for the second week in a row,
we're doing
it because we can. We're doing it. We'll be discussing the concepts of freedom and revolution in filmmaking and how the idea of each can be a truly double-edged sword.
I like that a lot, actually. Yeah. It's a good idea. But first,
I think so.
Jeff is here to inarticulately, and you wrote this, so I want to say you're going to articulately tackle some of our listener screenwriting questions. It's time to build yourself up, Jeff.
Let's be honest with ourselves.
You're great. But we've got some great...
I'm here.
We've got some great screenwriting questions, too, from you, the listeners. We'll point out, if you want to get in touch with us, send us screenwriting questions or general comments or just, you know, share what you've been up to during the day. podcast@filmschoolrejects.com. You can Twitter us @BrokenProjector, and you can go to BrokenProjectorPodcast.com. And you can also mail Jeff something snail mail style at an address that I'm making up right now.
So. Yeah, please, we're going to have a new segment on the show called The Days of Our Listeners.
I would love that, actually.
I would absolutely love that, too.
And our first question for you guys to kind of hit us back on response, the question this week is, why would the French give the apes another, technically a third Statue of Liberty?
Doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't. Can someone please help us out with this? And in the meantime, we will... we will help you out with some of your screenwriting questions here. Number one, from user @bhallucinations, asks, how do you like...
This is going to be good.
Yeah, right. Here, I'll read it this way just to make it special for you, Jeff. The question is, so man, how do you like keep story beats fresh and stuff and interesting? That's not how this... I'm not doing it justice at all. I just wanted to make sure, like, it was someone on shrooms. But the real question is, how do you like to keep story beats fresh and interesting? Jeff LaTulip.
I think and especially in comedy, you run into this all the time. I think it's more than anything, it's just being cognizant of what's come before you and what's sort of well-worn and the path that's well-tread and just kind of trying to think of something different. One of the things that I always try to do is to think about something that I've seen in a lot of movies, especially in a lot of movies that are like the one that I'm writing, and then play it out, but then somehow turn it on its head.
Yeah, sure.
I think that, and you know, we've talked about it a lot on the show. I think the movies that have done that the best recently have been the 21 and 22 Jump Streets, because they take, you know, all these really cliched tropes and just sort of manage to subvert all of them. Obviously, not everybody is going to write on the level of those guys, and that's okay. But I think it's sort of a mindset of tackling something where you look at it and say, okay, I know what I've seen in a trillion other movies like this. What haven't I seen? Or especially, and this is big for me, what can I draw from real life that's happened to me that I haven't seen happen to other people? Those are the ones that I think about. I think once you get going in that mindset, it tends to sort of bring about more comedy of that nature. That's a little fresher. But don't be afraid to, you know, take your characters and your stories to places that you haven't seen before. And don't be afraid to think, you know, what would I like to see in the next movie coming up? And then go ahead and write it yourself. You don't have to wait for somebody else to do it.
Yeah, there's an episode of Louie where he's like brought on as a kind of consultant to help with a screenplay that's being written or rewritten, mm-hmm. I should say. And the whole deal is like, you know, page one rewrite, and they open on the guy waking up and hitting his alarm clock and he's grumpy, which is right. The biggest cliche maybe of all time.
Yes.
And Louie basically turns it completely around and he wakes up, but then there's a dog there and it licks his hand, and like, it's so simple. It's just not what we're expecting. It's not like a revolutionary idea or anything, but it's just different. And whenever I think about that, I think, okay, here they've taken something there's going to be elements in any script that have been done before. You know, people, mm-hmm. people talk and people do things, and we've seen all of them pretty much. But I love the idea of maybe writing out your scene and looking at it through clear eyes and saying, this is fairly cliche. Like, there are things mm-hmm. here that I've seen before. And then just taking a pen and pad and saying, no kidding, at the top of the pad, how could this happen differently? And then just right. write a bunch of different ideas. Go nuts. Like, this is a Second City thing where you basically say, all right, well, this guy's waking up and is he on a spaceship? Is he waking up and he's instantly thrown against the wall because gravity shifts? Like, lose yourself completely in the what if and do small stuff, huge stuff, and then find what's right for what you're trying to do.
Yeah, it's kind of there's a little bit of a catch 22 in there, in that, you know, you want to trust your instincts, but at the same time, you always want to question them just to make sure they're right.
Right.
True story. Last night, I'm working on a script right now, and a very specific kind of script. And there's a joke in there that I know that I wrote last night, and I know I'd seen it before. And I spent it's like literally two lines of dialogue to pay it off. And I spent 45 minutes constantly rewriting these two lines, and I couldn't get it. So I got up and I walked away and I forgot about the script for an hour and a half. And I came back, and in 10 minutes I had it. Or at least, you know, to something that's satisfactory to me. Once you've seen enough movies and really read enough scripts, your brain becomes attuned to, like, don't do this. This is a hack move. You've seen this. You've seen this all before. Let's avoid this. Let's figure out something different.
And don't be afraid to type come back to this later and fix underneath the scene. Like, let yourself write the shit version too, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to ask you this about it. I always feel like you can sometimes hide these elements with an overarching fantastical idea. And it doesn't necessarily need to be high concept. But if you have just a great single idea that's overarching idea for the movie, and that's the central plot for it, sometimes I feel like there's a forgiveness that we have as an audience to say, well, this is normal things that we've seen happening in a fantastical situation.
Here's where that road splits, and you go from being cliche to not only being acceptable, but, and for lack of a better term, correct, is if it works within the story. It's sort of like, you know, the ending of a movie. Like, if you're talking about a romantic comedy, the cliched ending is a happy one where they get together and everything is tied up in ribbons and bows. But for a certain story that's really, really, really great, that ending might make complete sense. And then, even though it's something that's been done before, it doesn't matter because it works perfectly within the amazing thing that you've already built.
It feels so right.
There's definitely a level of forgiveness if something makes sense to the particular story. I would be wary because the bad side of that is saying, like, man, I've got this great concept. I don't really have to try with the other stuff.
Right.
Which I think is a hole writers can subconsciously work themselves into.
And is wholesale incorrect.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you want to be very careful of that. But absolutely, you know, if something feels right for your movie, mm-hmm. then as long as you've executed it well, don't worry about whether it's happened before. But at the same time, every chance you get, you want to try to do something different. And by the way, the caveat to that is it has to be something different that works.
That works.
So it's all a crapshoot, man.
Yeah. See, I read Rian Johnson's Looper script again recently, and I was taken aback by one of the action sequences that takes place. And I thought, wow, a lot of these beats are really familiar. Like, they just feel like the normal noir style action. And I thought, you know, it doesn't matter though. Like, I'm already with Joe. I love this character. I'm in it, and I know that that like Rian Johnson, the director, is going to turn this into something really cool with his DP.
So. Absolutely. And let's go to another even more specific, perfect example from that movie, which is the idea of the PKs.
Right.
Because there is absolutely nothing original about having TKs. Yeah, sorry, the telekinetics. There's absolutely nothing original about people who can, in movies, move stuff with their minds and all that kind of shit. And there's absolutely nothing original about saying these people exist within the world of this movie. Mm-hmm. But I think sort of the brilliant part is he didn't spend too much time explaining why that was. I think there's like a line that sort of like alludes to
there's
it.
There's a billboard that says, get yourself tested. It's like a genetic right. thing, and that's all you really need.
Right. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was a line like when he's in the car with what's his name? Paul
Dano.
Yeah, where he's in the car with Paul Dano and he's like floating, you know, a quarter or some shit like that. And he talks about the TKs for like 5 seconds and then it's gone. And that's great because the less that he discusses that, the more it's just the fabric of the world.
Right.
It's just built in. And then when you get into the latter parts of the movie and you realize why it's significant, there's no questioning like, well, wait a minute, why does this kid have that power? Because of literally one line and a choice he made that it's like, this is the way it is and we're not going to worry about it anymore until it's necessary.
Yeah, and he subverts the convention by introducing TKs and then saying they're terrible. Like,
it's yes, not, exactly.
We thought we were going to get superheroes. We got douchebags, basically.
They've essentially become the hipster douches of Looper.
And I love how you buy it. Like, at the beginning, yeah. You buy it, and it's like, yeah, like, they are douchebags. And then at the end, you're like, oh, I never even thought in this movie that, like, there would be a next generation of TKs. Like,
yeah, it worked for everybody but Script Shadow, which should tell you something.
It sneaks up on you. It's such a nice note. And at first, even if that had not had to do with anything else in the movie, it's just like, oh cool, TKs are part of the world, but they're dicks, so right. Don't worry about it. Every other movie is going to show them doing rad stuff, not this movie.
It sort of goes back to that rule that like everybody loves a magician unless he's your friend.
Oh yeah. I'm gonna stop practicing my close-up magic then, Jeff. So next question number two is from user Hadley Griffin, who we're big fans of and has had some insightful things to say in the past as well. At Hadlex is the user tag there. And the question is, what non-screenplay writing, novels, poetry, journalism, etc., do you turn to for inspiration?
That's a tough one. I tend to, because of the stuff that I write, I tend to pull most from real life. Especially writing professionally now, I think it's rare that I use a source that doesn't come to me as adaptable material for a screenplay. But as far as inspiration, I think honestly the thing that usually hits me on an emotional level the most and gets me thinking about other things in writing is usually song lyrics.
Okay.
As odd as that is to say, because I pay attention to lyrics much, much more than I used to, but I try as little as I can to pull ideas from other people's work unless I'm adapting it, just because it you know, if you spark a little bit of inspiration from something that was written or whatever and don't take it wholesale, obviously that's okay. But I guess I just don't find this happening for myself very often. I'm more of an appreciator of what other people do than somebody who gets inspiration from it.
Well, I think it's also difficult a bit to separate inspiration from just the day-to-day voracious nature of reading.
Yeah.
As far as novels, yeah, I mean, I don't know how to answer the question on that, because you read a ton of novels, and whatever you're reading, theoretically, whenever I'm reading something, especially a novel, especially narrative work, I am thinking like, wow, okay, this is a great idea. This is an interesting turn here. And I'm not going to like copy it down on my parchment paper, but I'm thinking like, man, all the time while I'm reading a novel, something will spark and I'll have to put it down and go write something.
Yeah, yeah, you just sort of absorb it.
But specifically, you know, just to name names, poetry stuff, I like Billy Collins a lot. I think he's really interesting and different. Obviously, all the classic stuff. Elizabeth Bishop is good. Just all the usuals, Ginsberg, people that, you know, you would teach in English class, I guess, or poetry class. I also embarrassingly, not at all embarrassingly, did slam poetry in high school and college.
Oh, wow.
I did, and I'm very good at it. And so that's right. That's how I met my wife. So, but slam poetry is also really, I love the rhythm to it. Saul Williams, Taylor Molly, Lily Myers, another great name. And then journalism, Wright Thompson is amazing because I think he's got Hunter S. Thompson focused, if that makes sense. It's Hunter S. Thompson without a lot of the like total random bullshit that I love Hunter S. Thompson, but come on, like sometimes it's indulgent and insufferable.
I have gotten drunk with Wright.
Oh God, he's so awesome. He's such a fantastic writer.
Let me tell you something. I got drunk, Wright did not, and I put up a fight. That man can put down some whiskey.
Yeah, I do not doubt it. He looks like he invented whiskey.
He does. But
on that front, Team Grantland, kind of as a whole, mm-hmm. I love some Vice stuff as well, some Atlantic stuff, anything that's feature writing, you know, that tells a narrative story about real people. New York Times does a lot of, especially Magazine does it. Mm-hmm. Chuck Klosterman does a lot of great stuff with it. I was going to say, on the novel front specifically, Tom Robbins is a big one for me because I think the guy is just owns adjectives and mm-hmm. is a great teacher that way. And the non-traditional thing here, no kidding, is that I roll through Reddit. I go through their questions in Reddit.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, this is really something I've realized over the past 6 months or so.
It's definitely unfiltered humanity.
It is terrifying most of the time.
Yeah.
But I will go through a Reddit, and sometimes a question will really spark my interest. Like, police officers, what's the craziest call you've ever responded to?
Right.
You know, serious stuff like that, or stuff that's weird or strange and out there, or stuff that's really personal. And I'll read those like questions that pop up, or I'll go through the like Today I Learned section.
Mm-hmm.
And no kidding, man, like it doesn't happen all the time, but every so often you read something on Reddit, you just get inspired by like, here's this weird thing that happened, and it kind of puts you off on the rabbit trail.
Sure. You know, I think to make a point on it, it's a great question, but at the same time, I don't know that it helps to know what other people draw inspiration from other than on like an anecdotal level. I think what's the only thing that's really important is what you draw inspiration from and how you draw it.
Sure. I think there's an element of, you know, maybe I'll try that kind of thing.
Sure. No, but, absolutely. Yeah.
Other than that, I mean, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's what you find inspiring might be totally different from someone else. So
if you're taking in stuff that you're really enjoying and whether you're using that as a catapult to write or not, you're doing something right.
Sure. And maybe read stuff that you wouldn't normally read. Just branch
yes.
out and try something different. But yeah, hopefully those answers are helpful to all of you. Thank you so much for the questions. We always appreciate when we get them. And if you want to send more, you can go to brokenprojectorpodcast.com, click on the little question mark thing, and you can email us podcast@filmschoolrejects.com. Last week on the show, we celebrated America's birthday by discussing the most American movie in America ever of all time in the history of America. And we were barely even able to scratch the surface of the discussion. You guys helped us out with some answers of your own. Team America, World Police, very popular. So this week, we wanted to dig a little deeper, without puppets perhaps, get a theme going, because we, above all else, are topical as hell.
That we are, Scott. And as such, what we wanted to look at this week were the concepts of revolution and freedom, but not in specific movies themselves, although I will provide some examples. We wanted to examine this from the perspective of creating a movie and a movie universe, both practically and in the abstract, because as they say, you know, freedom isn't free. In some cases, it actually costs $1.05.
It does. True.
And revolution has no guarantee of success. So, Scott, if we're talking these two specific things in filmmaking, what aspects of the process come to mind for you?
Risk, a lack mm-hmm. of a safety net, a lack of oversight are the mm-hmm. first that really come to it. So the best specific example that comes to mind for me is actually in the studio system, and that would be when Warner Brothers gives a filmmaker like Todd Phillips $30 million, which is a lot and yet a little,
mm-hmm.
And says, as long as you don't cross the 30 million, if you go to 30 million and $1, game over. But as long as you stay under this, you can do whatever you want. Cast who
right.
you want, make what you want, go to town. I love
right.
that.
Yeah, it's great. And it's usually, we talk about this as a double-edged sword because it really is. If you're talking about, like, think about outside the studio system. And by the way, all the examples that I'm going to use are actually inside the studio system. So, but it's a separate part of the conversation. But outside an indie filmmaking, you have, okay, you know, you might have put up the money to make this movie. But then when you actually go to make it, if you have nobody to tell you no, or nobody to sort of give a second glance to what you're doing, that freedom can become really toxic. toxic and it can ultimately ruin your movie. Whereas, you know, on the other hand, if you have the freedom to go do whatever you want, sometimes it can result in something great because there's not a thousand cooks in the kitchen trying to contribute to the same dish and overdoing it.
It depends on your level of self-scrutiny, and it depends on how specific your vision is. So we've talked about both of these filmmakers within the last few episodes, but what you described just initially made The Room jump to my head. Tommy Wiseau,
Total Freedom.
Make whatever you want, you get The Room, or you get something like Primer or Upstream Color. And, you know, Brian Koppelman mentioned that as a great example of just grabbing your ball sack and doing it. And here's a situation where, you know, you have a creator who has such a specific vision and is disciplined enough to rein themselves in order to make something really special.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you mentioned Shane Carruth, because I think Primer is like an all-time film. Like, I even the parts of it that I still haven't completely like worked through my brain yet, I love, because partly because there's always going to be that mystery there, but it's just something that I find so complete and so daring and so well done. On they made that for like $12. Whereas with Upstream Color, I thought that that was a prime example, and I realize I'm in the majority among, or in the minority amongst film freaks here, but I thought that there was nobody around him to be like, what are you doing? This doesn't make any sense. Because literally, I there was not a second of that movie that made sense to me on like a surface level or an allegorical level or anything. And I had people explain it to me, and I'm like, you guys read that somewhere. Like, there's no way you came up with that on your own. To me, that's the two sides of the coin. But at the same time, I love that Shane Carruth is willing to go out and make that kind of movie, and again, be daring with it, because even if it's not anywhere near as straightforward, you know, a narrative as Primer, which is kind of funny to say, it's still resulted in something that a lot of people find remarkable.
Sure. And I think that he particularly is outside of the kind of what I consider to be the NYU film student. I'm so sorry that it's not really exactly NYU film student, but you get the idea.
But everybody knows what you're talking about.
Everyone gets what it's like when they cast we need a Harvard type for, you know, a movie, and like you get people who went to Harvard and they're like, no, we want,
yeah,
you're not square jawed and white and blonde.
Right.
But so he's kind of beyond that, where there is an audience for sort of like, you know, masturbatory work that they're convinced that it's, you know, interesting when they're really imbuing it with a lot of their own concept to bulk it up. But, you know, Shane Carruth is this great example, especially for you, of one example where freedom worked very well and one example where freedom for you did not work at all.
Maybe
sabotaged it.
Let's talk about two studio versions of that. And the first one would be, this is the good side of getting freedom, and this is what ideally all directors work towards, and that would be Inception. Because Chris Nolan did a couple amazing movies for Warner Brothers in the Batman franchise, and then he was like, look, give me this budget. I have this insane thing that I want to do, which, by the way, I can't imagine any studio ever buying from like a first-time filmmaker or screenwriter. Yeah, even as brilliant as it was, I guarantee you they look at that script and go, what the fuck do we do with this? Like, nobody's ever going to understand this. And they give him $150 million, and he goes out and makes Inception, and it's phenomenal. And that is a great example of the studio saying, like, look, you've earned the shot to go do this, and you've done so well on the previous things that we trust you. And it's not like, I highly doubt they were completely hands-off, and they were like, just go do whatever you want. I'm sure that they had input, but they also trusted Nolan enough to go do his thing, and it worked out beautifully.
Well, and this is maybe an important lesson for aspiring filmmakers, is that you are not Christopher Nolan.
Right.
You may be Christopher Nolan at the following phase of his career, but you have a long way to go. And I think that's really honestly poisonous in a lot of ways, because we see so many successful filmmakers make things look so easy.
Right. And I think that we're going to learn a lot from Interstellar, because this is another one where it's like, hey, guys, You saw what I did for you. Give me another $150 million. And it's, you know, we're going to find out, you know, just how well he works again within the confines of, yeah, go do what you need to do.
Right.
The opposite of this for me is this is 40. And I am an extreme lover of Judd Apatow, and I'm sure that that will never change. But this is 40 felt to me, and you could feel it a little bit in Funny People, where it seemed like because he has such a talent for letting the actors run with a joke, letting a scene keep running until it's, you know, it's natural and then it stops being funny. And in Funny People, and especially in This Is 40, you could feel that getting away from him. For This Is 40, it was almost like it had no script and he just got people together and just like let them talk. And some of it was so funny. And there's a really, I would say, almost perfect movie in This Is 40 somewhere, but it's also bloated by like 40 minutes. And I think that it's one of those examples of the studio pulling too far back and saying, you know, you've made us a lot of money, go do exactly whatever you need to do. We're not going to say anything. And there was just nobody around who apparently was willing to be like, you know what, this doesn't quite work.
Right. And it's difficult because, you know, from my point of view, I always want directors to have final cut. I do
of
not
course,
want
absolutely.
Studios to be the ones with final cut. But at the same time, I also think that it should be mandated that there is a script Nazi hired for every single shoot that just goes up in memento mori style is saying like, hey, this doesn't make sense. Or hey, this doesn't make sense. And continually badgering the minor and the major points in that way and hopefully helping to shape, you know, an idea into something more cohesive.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I truly believe that this was an aberration for him. And by the way, I'm like, I don't want to pretend like mine was the majority opinion. A lot of people love this movie. I just saw it as like...
Well, a lot of people thought it was bloated as well. I think that's a pretty standard opinion.
But it's just, it felt like a little too much in it. And it felt like, you know, whoever was there, like helping him, you know, make final decisions on, you know, Knocked Up and the 40-Year-Old Virgin wasn't there in the same capacity for this one. So
it's also difficult, like when you have a filmmaker who casts his wife and children in these roles, to right off the bat, you look at it as being self-indulgent. So
you could. The funny thing about that is that for me, they ended up being the best parts of the movie. So I completely agree with your assessment. I don't know if that's an accident or what, but I agree you do very much so open yourself up to more criticism having done that.
Sure. So I think the question I have is this, like, you know, you've expressed both the good and the bad here. Is there a balance? Is there some sort of middle ground that's correct?
The balance is the good. You know, the balance is, I don't think there's necessarily a middle ground here, as in there's, you know, you have to have as a director and a writer, somebody to challenge your ideas. I believe for them to be truly good, you can't just do it all in a vacuum. You have to have, you know, just enough oversight that you talked about, that safety net, that you have something to fall back on, but you also need to be able to position yourself very high above it, you know, to you know, be able to truly create. And I think that the middle ground is the best case scenario, really.
Okay, so we're talking about how freedom can affect a movie, but what about filmmakers who are sloughing off everything and trying to just do something completely bonkers different?
Yeah, I think this one's much simpler and much cleaner, because you either have a revolution that succeeds or you have one that fails. I think in filmmaking, they most often fail. And when you talk about something like that, I think that one of the movies you have to look at is Battlefield Earth, because I think that
as a great success.
No, Scott.
Oh, sad.
Yeah.
No, it's terrible. That's disappointing. I agree too.
But I think that you have this situation where you have a lot of people, and this is kind of a key element to anything, you have a lot of people who really believed in it and really wanted to make something great. And for a million different reasons, they weren't prepared and they weren't good enough, and it just completely fell apart. And
that's where the echo chamber.
Yeah, exactly. And almost, you know, when you get Scientology involved, that's a whole different tomato. But it's one of those, it's almost like a failed mutiny.
A whole different tomato is going to be the title of this segment.
I like that.
So what was something that was revolutionary that actually worked?
Well, I would say The Matrix, because, okay, you know, you have two people with a, you know, who got an entire cast and crew on board with a very, very, very specific vision and a very, very specific way of wanting to make the movie, both, you know, in the narrative and especially visually. And this is one where it's like literal, like they created a new kind of way of shooting action scenes.
Sure.
There's really no way around it. And so these are two people thinking outside the box and really coming up with an entirely new system, for lack of a better term, to make a movie. And it's something that really worked. And, you know, that's the rare case in Hollywood where, you know, you just say, fuck it, and you go for it, and it works.
Yeah, an odd sort of case, again, where Warner Brothers gave them a couple dozen million dollars. Mm-hmm. I think it was actually $30 million to go do a proof that they could shoot what they were talking about shooting. And they did the intro sequence with Trinity and the chase scene there with the
right.
telephone booth. And Warner said, well, yeah, here's a bunch of money. Like, this is fantastic. Right. Go make the complete story here, which is, you know, the story that you want to hear more and more and more often, that a studio is giving some money to promising people and saying, no, that didn't work, sorry, and taking it as a loss leader, and then having other talent come by and say, oh my God, you blew our minds.
Right.
Here's money. You are going to crush this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, when you talk about middle ground, I think that there is a middle ground here in Revolution, because I think of something like Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow, which I personally love.
It. Love that movie.
I love it. And for some reason, I thought it was a completely successful Revolution that just didn't catch on.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, it just didn't. It had all the components there. And for me, it worked incredibly well. I would have loved to have seen 10 of those movies.
And maybe Speed Racer as well, to go back to the Wachowski, is like a failure that really could have been a big, big change in how like hyperkinetic films
sure.
would
and,
really
and
by, be.
And throw that into, you know, throw Speed Racer and Cloud Atlas, you know, for two different reasons.
Right, yeah.
In my eyes, as freedom failures.
Freedom
almost.
Failures.
You know?
I disagree, because I love both of those movies and find them to be tight and wonderful.
I enjoy the visuals of Speed Racer. I don't think it's a good movie, but Cloud Atlas is way up there. It's really good.
Nice. Well, coming up on the show, we will talk to two filmmakers who injected a lot of safety nets into their world because they had a lot of freedom as independent filmmakers, but they only had $6,000 to make their movie, which is a fantastic, great restriction on your freedoms. So we'll have that conversation coming up right now after some cool interstitial music. Greatest plague of filmmaking is money. Some filmmakers feel free when they have a lot of it. Some filmmakers feel free when they have almost none. But regardless of what you're trying to create, it's going to cost something. Oftentimes that price tag is too daunting for those of us happy to make rent on the first of the month. So let's say you can save up just a few thousand dollars. What could you make with it? Writer-director Joshua Caldwell has answered that question with the latest low-budget film to prove that a professional feature can be made with sweat equity. His film Layover features a Parisian woman whose flight to Singapore is canceled, resulting in her spending a night in Los Angeles. Fortunately, Caldwell and producer Travis Oberlander have taken the time to join us this week. Gentlemen, welcome to The Broken Projector.
Thank you so much. Very happy to be here.
Thanks. Very excited to be here. I'm a big fan.
Oh, thank you. So the first thing I want to point out is the talkiness of this movie, which seems like a natural fit for not having a lot of money. But what effect did having a small budget have on honing the script?
Travis, you want to start?
Well, really this idea sort of bore out of this sort of necessity to create a feature that Josh and I had, I mean, really since we started this whole journey of becoming filmmakers. But we kind of had made a unspoken rule that we wanted to create make a feature film before we were 30. And we were both staring that 30-year-old or that 30th birthday down and realizing that we, you know, hadn't gotten to that point yet. And we just sort of decided, well, we're going to make a movie for whatever we can get, however much money we can pull together. We have enough resources. We know enough people at this point in time. And Josh had been working on this idea that had been sort of bouncing around in his skull for a while about a girl stuck on a layover in Los Angeles. And at the time, we had talked a lot about it and bounced the idea around. And then I was working on a TV show called Whodunit at the time. So I told Josh, why don't you go ahead and take the first pass on the screenplay, and then we'll sort of collaborate on it like we usually do.
Yeah, well, I'd been watching a lot of French New Wave at the time, and I'd seen the film Contempt, and I was really blown away by, you know, this 30-minute long sort of semi-conversation that occurs in the middle of the film, in which two people are talking to each other and yet they're not really talking to each other. And it was the idea of sort of expanding on a different way of making a movie, a different approach to making a movie, and a different way of telling a story in which you're not relegated to 3 minutes per scene. And so that kind of seeing how it was done in another way and knowing that, you know, we weren't going to have the ability to shoot in tons of locations and have a lot of time and do that, was to really find a way to ground the story in dialogue and in character and give room for that to expand and that to reveal the story over time.
Yeah, there's kind of a Linklaterian, if I can say that, element to it, or Alain René vibe to it, because it is really...
Oh, please do.
Oh, okay. and for anyone who's afraid of French New Wave, maybe Linklater will be a better gateway drug, because I wince when French New Wave is brought up.
And I think, you know, but in regards to this particular film and the approach, the production approach, there's a lot to really take away from it. I mean, that really, you know, you see in a lot of French New Wave and Italian neorealism is essentially you see that a lot of their scenes where there's heavy dialogue or a lot of performance, they take place indoors or in controlled mm-hmm. situations. And then they have a lot of other scenes that certainly expand the scope of the story, but you can kind of tell they were shot like, you know, guerrilla style on the street.
Yeah, they did a great job of like hopping on a scooter, and they have that scene that makes it feel much bigger than it is, but that's only
exactly
like 45 seconds or a minute, you know, of them going through the streets and everything.
Exactly, or just walking along, and you could tell that all the sound was added later. But that production method was also a really big inspiration for our approach to the film, which was to say, well, let's set all these scenes with a lot of dialogue and a lot of like performance in these situations we can control, but then let's not let that stop us from really giving this a big, you know, canvas and really, you know, expanding the story beyond one location, which might be typically done with $6,000.
Right. How many passes did you do on the script?
You know, I think I only did about four passes. I had sat down to write, and like Travis said, I was like, let me just take the pass. And I don't consider myself sort of a writer from the blank page. So I was like, you know, I have a very particular vision of this. Let me just at least get down like what I can. So even if I tap out at 40 pages, somebody else can pick up the writing. And it literally, I think like a week or two later, I had a full draft. And you know, and shared it with some of my collaborators, and they were all like, this feels really good. Like, there's something really there. I'm like, are you sure? Really? Like, because I don't know. Like, you know, but I think Travis can attest to the idea that, you know, we could have gone in and really noted it to death, but it might have really kind of ruined the organic, you know, sort of feel to the film.
Well, I was going to say, and I mean this as a compliment, but there's something immediately within the film that is comfortable. We open basically with frustration because her flight's been canceled. And this is not just your, you know, Phoenix to Tucson flight. It is a flight from Los Angeles to Singapore. I mean, a very serious flight. She's got something on the other end that's important and she's stuck. But at the same time, when we're back at this hotel room with her having this conversation over a phone, there's something very comfortable and familiar about it.
That was certainly intentional. You know, that kind of first opening conversation, which we had a lot of discussion about regarding its length, was really intended to kind of ground you both in their relationship with her boyfriend and also just in the realism that we were trying to approach with this film, you know, and really just let the audience know from the get-go the type of film we were making, and yet also make it feel like, God, you know, I've had that conversation before and I've been in that hotel before. And everything is, very, like you said, very comfortable, but also, and I think that comes from a certain familiarity with the situation and what's going on.
Let me ask Travis, as a producer, what is your job on a movie with no money?
Well, on a film with no money as a producer, your main job, like, I mean, it really doesn't change from any other production, budgetary level wise or anything. Your main job is really just to make sure that you're the glue that makes sure that everything gets put together. And if something drops, you need to be there to pick it back up. So it was filling in any sort of capacity on set that was necessary and sort of being the organizational brain behind the whole thing, because we had to go about this production in a sort of a different style than normal. We shot entirely on weekends at night, like after dark, because the whole film takes place at night. So, and we did it on weekends so that we could allow for the flexibility of our crew to be able to work during the week. Because we worked with professionals, working professionals in Los Angeles who have gigs on a regular basis. And one of the only ways that we could collaborate with them was to make for a flexible schedule and make for a flexible production. So we did it over the course of a month, but it really only amounted to about 11 days of production.
Hmm. What did money go toward exactly?
Went towards paying our cast primarily. That was the largest percentage of our budget. And then feeding everybody and paying for the odd locations here and there. But for the most part, everybody else was volunteer. They were really just behind us in the production, and they really got the idea. We've been working with many of these people for a long time in our careers down here in Los Angeles.
I don't want to out you guys at all, but were you able with $6,000, did you have money for insurance?
No, we did okay. Not have any insurance. No, unfortunately, no.
But you did. I mean, did you go about getting permits and all that sort of stuff, or was a lot of it kind of guerrilla?
The whole thing was guerrilla. I mean, even down to, there's some surprising shots that pretty much everybody always asks us about, like it opens up inside of an airplane,
yeah.
Flying over Los Angeles. Entirely stolen. Everything in the in LAX is also stolen. I mean, this was a guerrilla film from the start. We didn't really have the time nor the desire to really slow ourselves down. There was really a sort of in the production of this and the approach to it, a very like a strong necessity of now, mm-hmm. that we just wanted to make this film, and like there wasn't going to be anything to stop us, whether it was budget or permits or insurance or any of the technicalities. We just knew that our approach to this was low and small enough that we would be able to get a lot for nothing, that we'd be able to get away with a lot of things.
Did you buy like a ticket from LAX to like San Diego or something to get her on
San Francisco, actually. So yeah, there's okay. Actually a lot of the shots that are inside of the airport that are LAX are actually San Francisco.
Okay. It's just an interesting way. And this is, it never really dawned on me, but again, this is movie magic where you see her flying in and, you know, we don't know where she's coming from. When she speaks in the hotel room, she's obviously talking about going far, far away. And so in my mind, I was like, wow, what an epic moment. Like they're on this plane and you don't know where it's coming from. It could have been from anywhere. And, you know, it's kind of beautiful the way that y'all set up kind of an epic story just by creating a script beat. You know, because y'all could have had her, oh, I missed my flight and I'm not going to be able to make it to Austin or whatever, but y'all, right. Y'all made it halfway across the world.
I think that that's actually an interesting point you bring up, and it's one of the tricks that we did. It's one of several tricks that we did in this film to actually create what is like considered production value on a film that is really has zero production value to it. I mean, the simple aspect of making this film entirely in French is adding a production value. It makes it very unique. We're American filmmakers. Neither Josh nor I speak French. I took like 2 years of it in high school, but that's it. And just simple things like the fact that she's riding around on the back of a motorcycle throughout the film, and we get a lot of epic driving sequences. It really breaks open the story and gives it this big production feel, even though it was done for nothing.
Thanks, Godard.
Well, and I think too, speaking to that is that, you know, when you're shooting, whether you are on $100 million production or a $6,000 production, it doesn't cost you money to put the camera somewhere.
Right.
And how you put and where you put the camera can greatly affect, you know, the audience's perception of your story. And so it's as simple as a big, what feels like a big wide shot with them in the motorcycle in LA and the night behind them was achieved by hopping in the back of my buddy's Tahoe with an image stabilized lens and one guy running camera and, you know, our actors on the bike.
Our director on the bike.
I didn't want to give it away, but I am the motorcycle rider.
uncredited yeah. on IMDb.
You can add that. But, and so that was really important going into this, which was to say, all right, well, we have this money, but this money is really just to support us getting to the place where we can craft the story. And as long as we do the story right and we create a scenario where, you know, there's a really big canvas here, and yet it's also very intimate and personal. Like, I felt comfortable stepping on to our set, so to speak, in quotes, and and shooting it no differently than I would if I had a crew of 50 people behind me and was on a, you know, Arri Alexa.
Right. So speaking of which, I mean, we talked about some tricks. We've talked about now camera placement and that sort of thing and motivation with not having much money. I want to talk a little bit about the challenge of two people talking, because the idea itself seems really simple. I don't have any money, so I'm going to make a movie about two people talking. And yet that is incredibly difficult. I mean, that is not an easy task to make interesting, particularly now. I mean, it wasn't easy in the 90s when Soderbergh and Kevin Smith were making those kind of things. And it's certainly not easy now when you can see a cat riding a goat. Like, now, I could do that right now, guys. I could look it up right now.
No, you can't, because that's our next movie. And okay. We would sue you.
Cat on goat.
Cat on goat.
That could be a different movie.
That's how the cat gets saved, actually, is the goat.
Yes. Have your hero place the cat on the goat. It's a secret chapter in that book.
Yeah.
Is it just, how difficult is it to create scenes of people talking on set, knowing that you might have to rely a lot on editing that may not be able to help you 100% if the performances aren't there to begin with? That's kind of a catch-22, I guess. But, you know, can you talk about the challenge of making that enjoyable, entertaining?
Well, I think this, you know, this might sound obvious, but I think, and this comes out of, you know, even going back to my short film Dig, which, you know, Scott, you featured on Film School Rejects, is, you know, the idea of taking two characters who in a way have a very different point of view or a different way of seeing things and putting them together and letting them hash it out. Now, in Dig, that's a guy holding a gun at the other one, and it's a very intense conflict that they're experiencing. But in regards to Layover, it's as simple as having, you know, our lead character Simone being in a certain place in her life, and her friend Juliet, who she visits in LA, being in a certain place in her life, and letting them sort of go back and forth, even really slyly. You know, it's not like they're arguing or they're fighting or they're, you know, it's a back and forth, but it's creating really specific, unique characters and then putting them in a room together and seeing what happens. And I think that is not an easy thing to do. It's sort of, but for me, it's where you start. It's the best place to start. And I think that even with the motorcyclist who is kind of on her side, it's not like they're ever, you know, fighting or anything like that. But I think that what's interesting is they sort of have a different point of view on the situation and they sort of talk that out. And, you know, it's not so much that they're likable, but that you kind of just like that. You know, it's weird because I don't know if they're necessarily likable, and obviously there's like some stuff going on that you'll find out if you watch the film. But I think crafting enjoyable dialogue and yet having it be in a way a conflict of some kind really helps, especially when you're doing things that are like 10 minutes long.
Yeah. I think, Josh, what, like, the biggest thing, like, there's a lot of gimmicks that you can do to create these sort of, make these scenes interesting to watch, like, have the characters doing something unique and or interesting while they're having a conversation. But we don't really have that too much throughout the film. I think what we found that worked is that we sort of, it's really about the stakes involved. Where are the characters at this scene? And then with these characters, specifically like Juliet and Simone, we hint towards a history, and there's something there that is never really fully said or stated, but the audience gets a sense that it's there, and that just sort of sets up stakes throughout. And we do that with every character in every scene, that even in the long talky scenes, that there is some sort of character grounded stake that's involved for each of them, and they're coming from their own unique perspective and their own unique place. And I think that makes for interesting scenes and interesting dialogue that people want to watch and interpret and analyze.
So can you tell us where we can watch your movie?
We're in talks with a couple of different opportunities for distribution. It's currently not available for like streaming or anything. We premiered at Seattle International Film Festival in May, and then screened at Dances with Films in Hollywood earlier in June. And then we have been accepted to the Scottsdale Film Festival, so in Arizona we'll be playing in September. And we're out to a number of other festivals, but currently there is, unfortunately, no way to see Layover just yet.
So try and set up a Google alert for Layover movie Joshua Caldwell, Travis Overlander. And
yes, we hope to have it out and available later this year.
Nice. Well, yeah. It's a great reminder that you can make a lot with a little, and a great reminder that you can have an adventure even in one night. So.
Yeah. Oh, and this also, just so everybody knows, if you want updates on the film, you can sign up for our newsletter at layoverfilm.com or like our fan page on Facebook for just search for Layover Film, and
you can
we'll be posting updates.
And you can check out the trailer, which is available, and it'll give you a taste of what $6,000 buys you.
That's a lot of explosions.
Yes.
Josh, can you tell us what your Twitter handle is, and then Travis, you as well?
Yeah, it's at @Joshua_Caldwell, CALDWELL.
And mine is at Tobiwan, TOBEWAN.
Nice. Well, we'll be on the lookout. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise here with crafting a feature-length film that looks gorgeous, it's very entertaining, and only cost $6,000, which I think is 1 month's rent in L.A., if I've done the math.
Yeah, about.
Joshua Caldwell, Travis Overlander, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
And that's our show this week. Note, we will be taking our summer vacation now, so there will be no show on the 18th or 25th, but we will see you in 3 weeks. And we will reveal our heroes of this week in just a few moments. But first, I want to tell you our interstitial music is from David Rosen. Opening and closing theme from the band Party Bats. Our announcer is Dave DeAndrea. Art design by Jen Lindemann at iCandyArt. The show is written and produced by me, Scott Beggs, and Jeff LaTulip. And our executive producer is Neil Miller. So, Mr. LaTulip, who is your hero this week?
My hero this week is my good friend Lizzie Kaplan, who just this morning was nominated for an Emmy Award for her role on Masters of Sex, and been a very, very long time coming for her. She's an incredibly talented young lady, and she really deserved that.
Yes, absolutely. Congratulations. My hero this week is writer, director, and comedian Elisha Yaffe, who made a stellar short film called Time Travel Lover, which you can see at Film School Rejects, or just Google it, please, and find it. It's on Vimeo, and it's
so good.
Hilarious. And so we salute you, Mr. Yaffe. Well done.
Very, very rarely is a short film worth 10 minutes of your time, but this one is for certain.
Nails it down. For everyone at Broken Projector, I'm Scott Beggs, reminding you that the Black for Alternates is in the ladies' room.
And I'm Jeff LaTulip, reminding you that there are two Fs in Jeff, boys.
And we'll see you in 3 weeks. We're taking a quick 2-week summer break, but we will be back very soon. See you then.
I recorded this for forever.